Hi, this is Art Umble with Stantec Consulting, and I'm the Senior Vice President with our company and Director of the Stantec Institute for Applied Science, Technology, and Policy. And you are listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations. By Xylem, Let's Solve Water. By the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. By Black & Veatch, building a world of difference. By 120 Water, new rules need new tools. By 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience. By Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services. And by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow. This is Session 258.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thank you for joining me and thank you for your support over the last 10 plus years. We have a fantastic show for you today. Snehal Desai, Xylem Senior Vice President and Chief Growth and Innovation Officer, joins us for a wide-ranging PFAS discussion. Snay addresses the EPA's recently promulgated PFAS rule and gives an absolutely fantastic breakdown on the technologies to treat PFAS and where technological advances are likely headed in the quickly evolving world of PFAS treatment. You're really going to enjoy this show. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of the show, and we have some fantastic sponsors this year. Our 2024 sponsorship lineup includes Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, and Intera. And that, my friends, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education, and thank you all for your support. I'd also like for you, the listener, to do me a favor, if you would, please. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please, please, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks will go. And hey, as long as you're letting the sponsors know that you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you access the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated and, of course, helps others find out about the podcast as well. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Now, it's time for the main event, our interview with Xylem's Snehal Desai. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Snehal, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Happy to be here and looking forward to conversation.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to tapping into your expertise on our topic du jour. But before we get into that, could you give us a little background, Snay, on your journey to the water sector, how you got interested in it?
Sure. Well, it's actually pretty longstanding because when I started right out of college, really back in the late 80s, I came into the sector more as a sales engineer, specifically responsible for separation technologies, reverse osmosis, membranes, ion exchange resin. So started a long time ago, but through the years, I've worked for a variety of different companies, Dow Chemical, which is now the DuPont Water Solutions business. I worked for Evoqua and now at Xylem. So it's spanned a long time. I've done a couple of other things along the way. But I started in water and I guess I'm still in water because that's kind of the deal with a lot of us in the industry.
Yeah. It has a way of, keeping you around.
Yeah, for sure.
So I wanted to chat with you about PFAS. Obviously PFAS is big in the news. It's regulations were just implemented or adopted. Can you, tell us a little about, you know, just kind of frame up the whole PFAS regulation issue, kind of what are we looking at when we hear about PFAS? What should we be thinking about?
Yeah, so and you're right, and we've been tracking this for a long time, and I've had the opportunity to be keenly aware of what's happened face of emerging contaminants, and specifically PFAS. So on April 10th, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency finalized really the first national drinking water standard to protect, you know, what by some estimates is roughly 100 million people from PFAS pollution, at least here in the U.S. And, you know, what that really did is help set a legally enforceable drinking water standard, you know, for those communities to help them, you know, be protected from exposure to PFAS. And up until now, we were really doing this on a state-by-state basis. So the big news is really that April 10th announcement that was much anticipated. And what that really helped do is set in place, you know, the maximum contamination limits. And once you have that, you know, real clear regulatory signal from the EPA, that really allows, you know, whether it's utilities, technology providers, you know, local regulators, all the people that need to be in the mix, they all kind of know what the rules of the game are and how we're measuring impact and ultimately how you deploy solutions. So, you know, this really has helped crystallize a lot of what's been happening for the last several years so that we can get on with really addressing this challenge. And I think the other thing to mention is that, you know, what utility customers are going to really need to understand is that, you know, the rule really puts in place what the EPA can, you know, enforce from being able to determine whether you're in compliance or not. It only tackles like a 6 PFAS, and there's many, many different versions of these chemicals under this family, but it's a start, and it really helps to let utilities know not only what they need to monitor, but what they actually have to be able to comply with.
Absolutely. I think that regulatory certainty that you've kind of highlighted helps remove kind of patchwork regulation and gives everyone a clear target of what we're aiming at here. I think that really, really helps. And I think it's not only helps the utilities, it'll help vendors and companies that are serving utilities, because you'll be able to develop products and services that are tailored to that particular regulation, right?
Yeah. Oh, of course. And I know that, again, kind of given experience in the space of regulation, both with, I mentioned all the different companies I've worked with, and of course it goes beyond that. I think this is a repeating theme we've seen in the regulated environment, in that, you know, the market always needs the firm signal from a regulatory body that has the authority to do so, such that everybody can then start to understand, you know, the rules of the game. And then that allows people to make investments. It lets them, you know, whether it be in capital for treatment, whether it's in innovation, you name it, right? So it's really a critical step in the process to have this clear signal.
Yep, absolutely. So you've kind of talked a little about the basics of the regulation. Can you talk a little about, you know, what's the period in which utilities are going to have to comply, and what kind of targets they're shooting at?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, what the guideline, what the regulation put out is that public water systems are going to have 3 years to complete their monitoring, their initial monitoring requirements. So, you know, establishing baselines, understanding what's in their feed waters, and then they have to inform the public about what that measurement has yielded, right? That will either be, that will tell them whether or not they've, you know, they're exceeding or under the 4 PPT limit. That's the maximum contamination level that is allowable in drinking water. And then, you know, once they know that information, the utilities will have, you know, up to a total of 5 years from the beginning of this process to implement solutions to reduce the PFAS levels in their drinking water to the levels below the standard. So it's like a 3-year measurement and then another couple of years to implement to get solutions in place. And frankly, I think this is important because the baselining, in some cases, there has been some work already done by various utilities. And then in other cases, they'll have to start that work now, right? So I think this kind of lays a roadmap for people to know when they need to have certain aspects of this process done such that they can be in compliance.
Absolutely. And it feels like that's a pretty long fuse. Is that long fuse, do you think, kind of to allow additional treatment options to develop and mature, or is it just Yeah, I'd love to hear your
thoughts. I think, yeah, I mean, it's a good question. But again, like I said, I think this is not atypical. It may feel like a long time, but I think that's the nature of what we learn about sort of the regulatory environment, and specifically as we move to, you know, implementation of some of these standards, and that baselining is critical, because you want to understand any variabilities, you know, depending on the source waters, things could be changing, right? So you want to get a good sense of what's happening. And then because mostly you're putting in investments that have an intention to last a long time, you want to make sure that you don't have to come back around again, right? So the timing is might feel like a long time, particularly on the baselining element. But ultimately, you know, that's really to ensure that whatever you do have to put in, if in fact you're above the limits, is being designed with the different types of parameters and variabilities that might exist for the utility. So I wouldn't say in some cases, would it happen faster? It probably will happen faster in some cases, particularly if they're well above the limits. And we'll talk about that probably a little bit on where we've seen some early action and what drove that. But I think generally speaking, this is a pretty consistent timing on how these EPA regulations get enforced. And we have some similar examples within the power industry, where the EPA also regulates what can be done on coal ash and on flue gas. And it followed similar timing of testing and then implementation period.
Got it. So what are the currently available solutions? I mean, if someone like you indicated, if they've got significant exceedances, what solutions can be rolled out kind of now?
Yeah, I mean, look, the good news is that solutions exist today. And, you know, as part of Xylem, you know, we have been a part of this for over 10 years. But, you know, the technologies that we deploy in the market, which are known and seen to be best available technology right now, as granular activated carbon, which, you know, utilities are quite familiar with. In this case, you know, the PFAS compounds are absorbed onto the surface of the carbon. And then, you know, these are really used pretty broadly and can be quite effective and relatively low cost. So granular activated carbon is one approach. And then ion exchange resins have been also seen to be quite effective. And this is where you really pass that contaminated water through a resin bed. And there, it's a slightly different technical, you know, connection, but ultimately it's doing the same thing, right? Where the contaminants are binding to the particles, and then you know, those PFAS molecules are pulled out of the treatment stream. We have seen in a couple of instances where reverse osmosis technology is also being deployed, albeit less so specifically for PFAS. I think it's going to maybe be a little bit more in the mix. But ultimately, you know, granular activated carbon, ion exchange resins, those are pretty much the ones that people have put in place. And then, you know, specifically in the case of what we're doing at Xylem, you know, we know that we have clients that are looking for permanent solutions, but we've also seen a rise in interest in mobile systems, meaning, you know, once you've determined that your levels are above the limits, and you're seeking to do the right design work to put in a permanent project, you know, the idea of, can we do something today temporarily to treat the water typically at the wellhead or the source such that we can actually work on the permanent install is something that we've worked on. We call it the mitigator mobile system, but it's just another way to take those same technologies I mentioned, granular activated carbon and ion exchange, and put them on wheels, place them where they need to be. And I, you know, usually they're being done on a temporary basis. So, you know, we know that those technologies are available, and those are the ones that are primarily deployed in the market and by ourselves and others to address customer needs.
Yeah. So where do you see the technology moving as, you know, because obviously my suspicion is a lot of money is going to be going into R&D for PFAS removal and destruction. So kind of where do you, you know, on this baseline of current treatment options, where do you see the technology going?
Well, I mean, if you think about this, Dave, there's kind of like, I call it three basic categories of what needs to be addressed here. First of all, there's the detection. So we talked about the three-year baselining, and then, of course, there'll be an ongoing measurement to make sure you're in compliance. There's the treatment element that I just mentioned. And then there's disposal or destruction, whether it's of the media that's being used or ultimately of the contaminant. And so on the detection side today, there's quite a bit of work that's being done in trying to get, you know, today you have to take these samples and send them off to a lab, and the process and the technology that's being used to determine the limits is a little more sophisticated, right? So you can't really do it in the field. But there are a number of companies, both established companies as well as startups, that are looking at how can we do that more in the field? How can we do that low cost on a detection basis? And we've been scanning that space as well, you know, looking at startups as well as our own analytics group. In the treatment category, I mentioned, you know, what's going on in that space with best available technology right now. And there, carbon and resins and membranes are being considered. And then, you know, where we see some opportunity is really when you get into that disposal destruction space, because fundamentally, the treatment, disposal, and destruction kind of all go together, and that it's one thing to take the contaminants out of the line of fire of the drinking water stream, but fundamentally, you have to do something with it. And today, there is disposal is one way, and disposal could be, you know, could be landfilling the media. But where we see the future is that really looking at how do you destroy the contaminants, whether they were on the media or you found another way to concentrate it up. And there we see a lot of really exciting work going on with a number of, you know, purpose-focused startups. And again, those three buckets are how we're seeing the technology landscape. But I think the key thing to really understand is that there's not really going to be a silver bullet on how to address this. So I would be shocked, and, you know, I'm not suggesting that I won't be shocked, but it'd be surprising to see that there comes out this one answer to every issue, because, you know, these are site specific. You have to really do the testing, the baselining. You have to understand what else is in the water. I think that's something that's maybe not as well understood, but I think those that are closer to the industry do understand this, that, you know, you have other contaminants, and whether it's organics, whether it's salts, whether it's, you know, you name it, there are other considerations that then end up going into the scheme that you put in place to treat. And so I think that, you know, you'll see that the testing, understanding treatment goals, understanding what kind of footprint constraints the customer might have, all those things are going to weigh into figuring out what's the right combination of solutions that you can put in place. And as I said, if you were putting in things to today, you know, we kind of know what that would look like. And then as the emergence and the development of these new technologies come through, you know, that your options become a little bit greater. And ultimately, it's really trying to make it easier for the utility customer to be in compliance, to also make sure that you can deliver on the regulatory environment. So,
yeah, that is one insightful answer. I think the way you broke it down into the buckets and kind of where things are going, I was impressed with that answer. So, Snay, based on existing technologies, what are some kind of current examples of successful PFAS remediation that you've been around?
Yeah, there's quite a few, actually. Kind of look back, I think it's been probably over 10 years where, you know, we've been working with clients across a number of different sectors, you know, more than 80 plus communities that, you know, found that their source waters, their challenge was well above the 4 PPT. I used to say this even a couple of years ago, because, you know, we were all waiting for the EPA regulation. And, you know, whether the number was 4 or 10 or 20, if you were doing the testing as a community and you found that your levels, well, let's say 200 parts per trillion, you kind of didn't need to wait to figure out what the number was going to be. You knew you had to do something. And so we've seen customers across the country, you know, employ solutions that are available. A couple notable ones, because we've been able to talk about them publicly. One is Strathmore Hills Water District in Colorado. The other one's Orange County Water District in California. And those are really good examples of the way that those utilities working with their community leaders have focused on solutions to remove PFAS from drinking water. In the Strathmore Hills situation, you know, they deployed really a ion exchange treatment solution. And that helped them get well below the compliance limits and mitigating any water quality issues they had. In the case of Orange County, they actually took an interesting approach where they deployed, you know, 30 plus really unique vessel designs that we kind of had innovated inside of Evoqua at the time that allowed them to put in place the media that made sense to treat the water at the wellhead. And the importance about that vessel design, and think about future-proofing, is that in some of the communities, and I'm not going to say that it's this is the Orange County situation, but I know of others that it is that they're kind of bringing their water in from the aquifer. And in some cases, they're seeing the amount of PFAS maybe coming and changing, right? There could be a plume. In fact, there was a plume in parts of California where what they thought the initial contaminant level was changed over time. And also the number of different PFAS constituents might have changed. So what they were able to do is following change in the California law and back in 2020, you know, Orange County really did a nice and very thorough study on different technologies, different approaches. And then they deployed these quite flexible vessels that allow them to go carbon to resin, resin to carbon, depending on what has to happen down the road. And ultimately, you know, they put in place quite an effective solution that's really protecting drinking water for over 2.5 million customers. So those are a couple of examples that we've been able to work with, and they've been willing to talk about it, right, which is important. But that's a good news story, right, because these are very well-known water districts tackling challenges and willing to talk about it, which will really set the stage for others as they start this journey to learn, you know, what the right approach might be, what are technology solutions. And then in some cases, you know, whether it's working with companies like ourselves at Xylem or reaching out to their peers to figure out how to navigate this environment, this technical challenge, as well as, you know, a community challenge as well, to make sure that we're safeguarding our drinking water supply.
Yeah. So you just mentioned challenges. So what do you foresee being the biggest challenges to, you know, compliance with the US EPA's regulation?
Well, it's just a few places. I mean, technology is one, and I think I broke that down pretty well. I believe at the front end where we talk about, you know, needing to really understand the situation on the ground and understand the constraints to then put together the right sequence of solutions. So I don't think that's a complication or a hurdle as much as really needing to work through that in a systematic way. And that's where, you know, whether it's ourselves or engineering companies, and others, you know, there's a lot of people that are really helping work through that process. I think the other big one is around financial considerations, right? Because this was not originally built into many people's capital plans. But the good news there is, I mean, first of all, the EPA, their estimates around the cost of compliance is somewhere around $48 billion. So it's a pretty sizable number. Now, I've seen all kinds of numbers, but let's just start with what the EPA put in place. But what that was also backed up by it, and this was announced on that April 10th message. You know, the EPA also announced nearly $1 billion in new funding available through the bipartisan infrastructure law that's going to help the states and territories implement testing and treatment in the water systems, and also help private well owners, you know, to be able to address contamination. In addition, you know, we know that there was $9 billion of investment that was also announced earlier to help communities that were impacted by PFAS in the drinking water. And then even another additional 12 that's more generally available for drinking water improvements, which of course, some of that would go toward things like mitigating PFAS. So it's not to the tune of $48 billion, but the financial implications of this are considerable. And the good news is there is money that is being allocated and made available through the infrastructure bill to be able to help offset some of that. So, you know, it's at least a help for the utilities. But I think those are the two big ones: technology, and then ultimately, you know, the affordability.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're already struggling with affordability issues, and ratepayers are going to have to shoulder some of that burden. I mean, even some of the recently announced PFAS settlements involving, you know, the companies that produce this chemical they may contribute to that $48 billion, but again, there's the burden's going to fall on the ratepayers, at least some of it.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me ask you this. That was just on the drinking water side. Do you foresee solutions coming in on the wastewater side to, you know, destroy PFAS or remove PFAS in wastewater effluent streams that could that could essentially help the drinking water side?
I think so. I mean, interestingly enough, I mean, it's a different set of situations and problems. We are working, I mean, frankly, you have the drinking water, you have the wastewater. We are seeing needs within the industrial sector as well. Whether it be, you know, their same issues around finding PFAS somewhere in their process water streams, oftentimes coming in through the source water, other times coming through, you know, other means. So we're seeing a lot of different end markets that are starting to tackle this challenge. But on the wastewater side specifically, yeah, I believe we're going to see some opportunities there and need. I mean, there isn't, that's not where a drinking water standard actually applies. But fundamentally, when you think about what goes through our systems and finds its way into our wastewater streams, you know, there are indicators of PFAS, albeit that's not regulated, but it's expected to be there. And primarily, I think the big issue there is around biosolids, which is where you would potentially, between the sludge and the biosolids, where the PFAS would typically accumulate. You know, we know that some of the effective ways to deal with the sludge coming out of those systems would be to land apply it or do something like that. If that pathway is closed because of the because there is a high amount of PFAS that's been essentially accumulated in there, you know, that becomes an issue. The treatment schemes are going to look a little different because they're, you know, things like carbons and resins and things of that nature, not very effective for sludge streams. That's where I think some of these next generation destruction technologies are going to come in even more into more sharp focus. Because there you could actually see needing to do something very different to manage a semi-solid waste stream as opposed to, you know, liquid stream. So more work to be done on that front, but I don't think we're going to, we won't be treating our wastewater streams, both the liquid and the solid phases, solely for the purposes of protecting the drinking water. We're just trying to get after all the places it could show up. Because there's quite a bit of work that's being done as it's a phase out from a manufacturer's point of view, meaning those that are producing these chemicals, but the persistence in the environment is there, right? It's showing up in our wells, it's showing up in a variety of surface water streams, et cetera. And so being able to treat it both at the drinking water level so that as humans, we aren't consuming it, but also it's in the environment. And I think wastewater plants oftentimes are where those things accumulate. So I think we're going to find ourselves also trying to knock it out in that phase. But that's a little bit more early days on that side as we're seeing the landscape unfold. And as Xylem, you know, we work across the water cycle. So we see the level of activity. It's very active on the drinking water side. And it's starting to get more active on the wastewater side.
Great insights there. You know, clearly PFAS is one of the bigger issues that utilities are facing. So, you know, what are the next steps do you think that we're going to need to undertake to take this challenge head on?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's something that, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about. I kind of break it down this way. I think first and foremost, you know, water utilities are already under a tremendous amount of pressure, whether it's around just the state of their infrastructure, the labor force they need to keep in place, you know, engaging with their communities, et cetera. But, you know, we need to support those utilities from all the stakeholders that can help, because it's going to take a concerted effort, whether it's around tailoring their plans of response, deploying treatment solutions that are specific to their environment. And as we mentioned, you know, the funding, which I think there's, you know, some steps that have been made along the way from the EPA. You know, the good news for them, though, is that we're not starting with no evidence of success here. We know that there are utilities and also technology providers like Xylem that have been around and for a while that are helping deploy solutions that can help them get the job done. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's going to be the benefit of all as we collectively start to address this challenge that we're sharing what to do and how to do it. And then ultimately, there's also this conversation with communities about what's being done to give them more confidence in the drinking water that's being served up. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, experience and seeing a lot of different situations helps. And that's where we're really seeing a lot of activity within Xylem. People understand our level of experience in this space. And, you know, putting technology to work, thinking about the very specific situations, But you know, that we're just one of many companies that are doing that. And I think that's going to be critical as we go forward of people bringing forward that kind of consultative approach to the utilities to help them figure out how to navigate what the requirements are today. And, you know, we would imagine and expect that, you know, as we learn more about characterizing these emerging contaminants, with PFAS being a big class right now, you know, that these needs are going to continue to evolve. So I think the next steps are really that, right? Just being able to engage with utility leaders, educate them on what the situation and the options are, and then, you know, work through pretty well-known processes to be able to help them put the right solutions in place.
Fabulous. I mean, Snay, you've been amazing today. You've been absolutely great. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Before we say goodbye, for those who want to find out more about you, your work, and Xylem, where can they go to get that information?
Well, I think the easiest place is really to visit us at xylem.com. Our social LinkedIn presence also does a very good job of highlighting the kinds of things that are being done by our customers and partners. But, you know, it's an easy way to find out what's happening in the space. And, you know, listening to folks like yourself that are shining a light on this, I think that's always good to get the word out and to socialize it. But I think that's it's probably the best way to find out about keeping up with what's happening.
You know, Snay, thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us and your insights. So thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dave. Enjoyed the conversation and appreciate the time.
You bet. Bye now.
Bye.
Phenomenal interview by Snay. Just phenomenal. With terrific perspectives on the EPA's PFAS rule and the current and anticipated advances in detection, treatment, and eradication of PFAS. Thank you again, Snay. I really appreciate your time and insights. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast. Click the first link that comes up. That takes you to a landing page on Bluefield Research's website. The Water Values LLC and Bluefield Research are not affiliated entities. We just have a joint marketing arrangement, and as part of that, we get a home on the web on the Bluefield site. So thanks, guys. You can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that landing page I mentioned earlier as well. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include Xylem, the American Waterworks Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, and Intera. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource. So please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.